Hello, everyone. Welcome to another of the six lectures being given by the Slade Professor of Fine Art for 2021. These lectures are an important tradition at the University of Oxford. John Ruskin was the first to give a series of public lectures on art in 1870, after being appointed as the initial Slade Professor of Fine Art. Every year, a distinguished scholar is asked to follow in his footsteps. My name is Geoffrey Batcher, and I am Professor of the History of Art here at the University of Oxford. It is my great pleasure to introduce this year's Slade Professor, Dr. Geraldine D. Dodds. Jerry Dodds is Harlequin Adair Darman Professor, Faculty of Art History at Sarah Lawrence College in the United States. Professor Dodds' scholarly work is centered on medieval Spanish art and architecture, and especially on issues of transculturation and identity formation. Among her many publications are Arts of Intimacy, Christians, Jews, and Muslims in the Making of Castilian Culture, a renowned co-authored textbook. In addition to her other books, catalogues, and essays, Jerry has also curated a number of important exhibitions and made films to accompany them. In 2018, in recognition of her exceptional contributions to the dissemination of knowledge of Spanish history and culture, Professor Dodds was the recipient of the Cross of the Order of Civil Merit from the Government of Spain. We are honored that Professor Dodds accepted our invitation to deliver this year's Slade Professor of Fine Art lectures, and I now happily hand over the microphone to her.
Thanks so much, as ever, Professor Batchen, for your kind words. My abiding thanks to the Committee for Slade Lectures for this honor, for the support of the Department of Art History, and to Liz Green and the Torch team. This celebrated miniature is part of a manuscript of Beatus of Liébana's commentary on the Apocalypse of St. John, painted by the artist Mayus near the frontier of Asturian and Leonese and Umayyad lands around 945. It depicts a scene from the Book of Daniel, included here because St. Jerome's commentary on the prophet was added as a kind of Old Testament mirror of St. John's prophecy. You might know this story. King Balthazar has defiled the vessels of the temple. He's using them to feast with his nobles, wives, and his concubines. And Mayus gives this last part of the guest list, the concubines, particular attention. As Balthazar is feasting, fingers appear from behind a candlestick, as if it were, the text says, the hand of a man writing upon the surface of the wall. The frail picture of the prophet Daniel watches the hand write three words on the white voussoirs of a red and white banded arch, and interprets the words to mean that Balthazar's impious kingdom will fall. This is the earliest surviving appearance of this event in the Beatus manuscripts, and though Mayus looks to Bible prototypes for other images of his Daniel cycle, this is not one of them. The slightly later Leon Bible of 960 gives us only a disembodied hand. Now, Balthazar's dinner guests are indebted to Roman tradition. His diners recline very much like Dido and Aeneas in the 5th century Roman Virgil. Even the servant offering wine is here, though from the opposite side. And yet, the setting is very different. The palace of Balthazar is depicted as an arch that draws a new, instantly recognizable meaning into the narrative. The words from his dream are written on its very voussoirs, and they give a contemporary meaning to Daniel's prophecy, as Menendez Pidal noticed long ago. An architectural form becomes a signifier for a vilified Islam. Thus, the great mosque of Cordoba, and by extension the Umayyad Emirate, takes its place in a visual historia that links the miniature's present with divine history. Apparently, the Umayyads were not the only ones who saw banded arches as emblematic of their rule on the Iberian Peninsula. Now, the horseshoe arch itself alone appears indiscriminately throughout the tumultuous story of the end of times told in the Morgan Beatus. And in these cases, workshop convention and elaborate decorative formulas obscure the arch's structure. But this Daniel page is uncommonly structural and specific, and unique within the context of the manuscript. It shows a consciousness alive to how an architectural motif might shape an identity, and it reaches out of its textual discourse into contemporary contemporary times. In the Tabora and Girona Beatus, painted by disciples of Maius and from the same family of manuscripts, the image might still maintain the same ideological message, but without the same immediacy. A more conventional composition centers Daniel, disconnecting the action from the arch, as John Williams, the master chronicler of the Beatus tradition, noticed. But the Morgan page bears all the marks of Maius's personal invention. The tilt of Daniel's head as he looks up to read the writing on the wall. The positioning of the candlestick so that the hand can write directly on the white voussoir of the arch. Maius's image might suggest resistance to Umayyad hegemony in the 10th century, and yet the text of the 8th century commentary on the of Beatus is famous for what is seen as an almost perverse refusal to explicitly align the very recent Islamic conquest of the peninsula with the end of times that was its subject. Lucy Pick, however, considered Beatus's text in terms of its segmented episodes, in which the reader was invited to meditate, quote, within the gaps of a narrative in order to complete the mental images evoked. The commentary did not so much provide answers, she proposes, as it outlined patterns of thoughts and behavior and suggested avenues of comparison between past, present, and future. So though Beatus in the 8th century does not explicitly mention Muslims in Spain, he invites the incorporation of contemporary history into his readers' meditations. The combination of text and image uses what Mary Carruthers called res memorabilis, clues for meditative reading, connections inviting the active reader to fill in the gaps between present and future. Something we're surely meant to do when the Whore of Babylon appears cross-legged on a cushion. Not all of the manuscripts of the Commentary of the Apocalypse of Beatus are so intensely engaged in contemporary reference, but Maius's masterwork in the 10th century seems, to some scholars, to have been one. The page predicting Balthazar's downfall might also function within the long exegetical tradition of Daniel 2:21. God changes times and ages, erects and transforms kingdoms. Now, Jerome's understanding was that it was by the will of God that kingdoms are governed, altered, and terminated, and that men only intervened in the grand course of history when their sins excited God's anger. In the north of the peninsula, where the Morgan Beatus was made, the Chronicle of Alfonso III represents the Umayyad conquest as a scourge allowed by God to punish the Goths temporarily for transgressing divine law, until kings like Alfonso III of the north might lead his chosen people back to their promised land. And this is from a wonderful analysis by Kenneth Wolfe. In the chronicle, the Umayyad caliph is called the King of Babylon, and Muslims are often called Chaldeans after the Babylonian dynasty, or satraps after Babylonian governors from the Book of Daniel, an evocative metaphor appearing in texts both from the north and the south. This allows us to see this particular image of Babylon on the left from the introduction to Daniel in Maius's Beatus in context. The city entirely embraced by serpent-like dragons. Its long inscription includes the words, "And the vessels of the Lord were carried from Jerusalem to Babylon by King Nebuchadnezzar. And because of the wrath of God, there are dragons, ostriches around the city, and owls, and sirens sing seductively in the wicked city." I don't find the owls to be particularly threatening, but the dragons are. The abduction of the vessels spoken about in this image connects this surreal and threatening image to the moment of truth regarding those very vessels during the Feast of Balthazar, which is depicted, of course, further on in the same manuscript. a drawing that copied a similar image of Babylon from a related Beatus manuscript was joined in the Rota Codex by a drawing of Nineveh, together with, interestingly, a drawing of Toledo. What, Manuel Diaz y Diaz asks, do these cities have in common? He responds, they were all cities destroyed for their sins, as the Chronicle of 754 explains. Musa forced his way into Toledo, the royal city, decapitated its noble lords who remained, devastating Hispania by the judgment of God. This conviction is echoed in the 10th century among Christians living under Umayyad rule in an interaction between John, Bishop of Cordoba, and a censorious John of Gorse, who had traveled all the way to Cordoba in the 950s on an embassy from Otto III to Abdulrahman III, in the very years that the manuscript was being painted in the Christian kingdoms in the north of the peninsula. Consider, the Cordovan bishop said to the Ottonian envoy, as he waited endlessly for his audience with the caliph, perhaps in the new Medina al-Zahra. Consider, the Cordovan bishop said, under what conditions we live. In the midst of the great calamity we have suffered for our sins, we still owe it to them, the Umayyads, the consolation of letting us live under our own laws and living very closely and diligently our Christian faith. Of course, Bishop John was an apologist for the majority of Andalusi Christians who had remained, as peoples of the book, protected monotheists in all Andalus. Christians lived in self-governed communities. They could worship in their own churches, though not embellish them or build new ones, and were held to other restrictions regarding ritual display and social subordination. But what was perhaps more difficult for some was that the church in Al-Andalus was no longer entitled to the substantial prestige and political power it had enjoyed under Visigothic rule. This was one catalyst for the voluntary martyr movement of the 9th century, in which 48 Christians were executed for apostasy or purposeful blasphemy. These Christians were a vocal minority who Anne Christie has called a group of extremists whose actions were at best an embarrassment to the Church of Cordoba. But they were prolific writers. And then in the mid-9th and 10th centuries, certain groups of Andalusi Christians traveled north to reestablish their monasteries in the Christian kingdoms. Did they chafe against the same complacency that excited the righteous indignation of John of Gorse and the martyrs of Cordoba? And what would be their place within Christian-ruled lands? Maius's Beatus was likely made in the monastery of Tabora in the north of the peninsula, in an area near the Duero River that had only been informally settled since the 8th century. It was not exactly depopulated. Rather, there was a demographic fragmentation and decentralization of authority that had occurred over perhaps a century and a half, a minor bit of political chaos into which the Asturian and Leonese monarchs jumped with glee, appropriating new territories and appropriating political and administration and administrative organization, in particular during the 9th century reign of Alfonso III. This process incorporated a number of strategies and players, including an expanding nobility, existing and displaced lay persons, and also the resettlement of monastic institutions, both indigenous communities and entire monasteries who came from Al-Andalus, in a symbiotic relationship with the Leonese monarchy, which utilized monastic institutions to consolidate annexed lands. The colophon of Maius's Beatus states that it was made for a monastery of San Miguel. We know it was located, at least in the 14th century, at the monastery of San Miguel de Escalada, so that it seems likely it was made for the monastery. And San Miguel de Escalada had originally been founded by just such a group of Andalusi Christians who came, in the words of their own dedicatory inscription, from Cordoba, their patria, as part of this strategic repopulation. San Miguel was at the center of a group of buildings that had long been known as Mozarabic churches, and still are in some quarters. And their study was set forth in a remarkable book of Manuel Gómez Moreno 100 years ago, Iglesias Mozárabes. A monument of fieldwork and research It created a canon of largely 9th and 10th century buildings that Gomez Moreno saw as reflecting the singular impact of Arabized Christians on the Iberian Peninsula. In using the term Mozarab, he was following common 19th and 20th century usage, which identified a Mozarab as a Christian who lived under Islamic rule. The word itself is more complicated. It's derived from Mustarib, a word that does not appear in Arabic written sources on the Iberian Peninsula, where Christians are referred to as Ajam or Nasara, among other terms. It does, however, derive from the Arabic lexicon and has a complex history. It can reference peoples of any religion who assimilate to Arab customs, though a long historiographical habit of thinking on the Iberian Peninsula changed the ethnic differentiation to a religious one. In the medieval Iberian Peninsula, it survives only in Latin documents beginning in the 11th and 12th centuries. Thus, the Arabic term was one known but apparently seldom used in Al-Andalus, but then brought north by members of the Andalusi Christian community, where it was employed in places like Toledo in the interaction between indigenous Christians and the others, Castilians and Franks, with whom they were obliged to come to terms as a collective in a new colonial world. Thus, the 1118 Fuero General de Toledo lists different groups to whom the code pertains, all citizens of Toledo, Castilians, Mozarabs, and Franks. But in 1919, Don Manuel used the term to modify artistic production, seeing in the architecture he called Mozarabic, quote, a stepchild of Cordoba, a perfect reflection of the absorbing cultural ambience of Arab Spain. But then he also speaks of his fear, and I quote, that outside of Spain, our chronology for these buildings will be criticized, repeating that in Spain, there's no Christian art before French Romanesque. His work was part of the construction of a national narrative that he hoped would reveal a uniquely Spanish spirit, a folkgeist, emerging from the peninsula's uniquely culturally and confessionally diverse Middle Ages. And so his great subject, and also its name, had to insist on this unique cultural experience at the same time that he lamented the difference at which he imagined it placed him from the rest of Europe. And so into this, the sort of flames of this indecipherable koan, he threw the one form that signified alternativity from Europe, the horseshoe arch, as a defining form. Consequently, incorporating countless buildings into his group that had little or no connection to the Mozarabs, that is, to Christians from Al-Andalus. For the horseshoe arch was characteristic of Iberian late antique architecture, both late Roman and from the Visigothic periods, as Gomez Moreno well knew, not just to those connected to Al-Andalus. Mozarabic, if applied to all these works, propels us to privilege the parameters of that descriptor, Arabized. It brings with it assumptions regarding the level of acculturation of an individual and impedes us from seeing any patron or their works in all of their complexity as we witlessly attempt to reify the implications of the name we used. Mozarabic art must be Arabized. When I first wrote about San Miguel de Escalada, it was in the way of an attempt to recuperate the church's non-Arabized meanings from the thrall of the term Mozarabic. I saw the horseshoe arched arcade and partitioned space of San Miguel de Escalada as far from Islamicate, but rather historicized and resistant. It seemed intransigently frozen in an imagined pre-Islamic history of the peninsula, typical of a church built before the advent of the Umayyads, the late antique architecture of the Visigothic period. And I compare it here to the 7th century arcade of the Church of San Juan de Baños. Was this a copy? No. It was more like an approximation of a style remembered, something different from the indigenous architecture developed in the far north under the Kingdom of Asturias, which did not, by the way, use the horseshoe arch. You'll possibly become very weary of horseshoe arches before this is done. San Miguel's interior seemed to me to be a stern, austere response to the emblematic polychromy of the illumination from the Morgan Beatus, a position echoed in texts from the voluntary martyr movement. Resistant, like Paul Avar's famous lament, where is the Christian layman who reads the Latin commentaries on these scriptures? For everyone who can write a letter to a friend in Latin, there are 1,000 who can express themselves in Arabic with elegance. It seemed to me that for Andalusi Christians who came north, the loss of Christian cultural hegemony and frustration at rhetorical silencing were key issues for a sector of the church invited to subsist under Umayyad rule, but with a bitter, though highly mythologized, memory of lost political and cultural hegemony enjoyed under Visigothic rule. But then they were a minority. The path in this work had been laid for me by the inimitable Isidro Bango Torviso, who in countless studies of what he and José Camón Aznar called repopulation architecture, offered a rethinking of this signal group of buildings that were at the heart of Spanish history and historiography. Bango brought to light 9th and 10th century dedications that declared churches were built quote, from the foundations of an abandoned site, or quote, on the foundation of an old church, or on a site abandoned 200 years or more. In some cases, the presence of Andalusi monks in this royal resettlement project was explicitly laid out in carefully orchestrated scenarios. The dedication of San Martin of Castañeda reads, "This place, with a small building of old, for a long time lay in ruin until Abbot John came from Cordoba to build it up." Or of San Miguel de Escalada, "This place, with a little building of old dedicated to the Archangel Michael, long lay in ruin until Abbot Alfonso, coming with his brethren from Cordoba, his patria, built up the ruined house in the time of Prince Alfonso." And then that same prince bought a site of a ruined monastery of Saints Facundus and Primitivos to give another Abbot Alfonso, who came from España, Al-Andalus, with his monks. And the building of abandoned sites could also be described in more detail, ex more antiquo, in the old manor. But what did the old manor mean visually? If the program involved a reconstruction of Visigothic monumental topography, were there models from the period of Visigothic rule in the north of the peninsula for this program? Indeed, there are few churches standing today from the late antique architecture of Visigothic rule, but it's important not to make the mistake of looking at the problem of a lack of surviving models in the 10th century as evidence that there were no models. Or since I seem to be stuttering, let me put it in Jeremy John's words: the absence of evidence is not the evidence of absence. I might get a tattoo of that someday. This, however, leads us to very contested ground today. Archaeologists in Spain have been tireless since the 1990s in reassessing churches that had originally been designated Visigothic out of a 19th century ardor for a romantic national identity. Excavations have corrected many of these attributions, and there have also been, on the other hand, important archaeological finds, including the new sites revealing large-scale construction during the Visigothic rule. But there's also been, among some, something of a systematic attempt to dismantle the corpus of late antique buildings of the Visigothic period in the service of a theory that large-scale and ashlar construction only blossomed after 711 when, it is posited, the Umayyads are thought to have brought construction traditions and forms from Syria. These traditions, the theory goes, were brought north by Andalusi Christians in an, and I quote, "eastern channel of transmission," without the intervention of an indigenous style of note. Forgive me then if I take a moment to defend the ancient honor of only two of the buildings swept up into this theory, which I consider to reflect late antique tradition from the Visigothic period, Santa Maria de Melque and San Juan de Baños, not proposing them as specific models, but as a way of stabilizing our understanding of the kind of models that might have existed during the 9th and 10th century resettlement, as northern monastics were constructing, or they would say reconstructing, a new identity on the frontier. Santa Maria de Melque, a grand vaulted cruciform building of almost cyclopean ashlar and horseshoe arches, has no dated stratigraphy in its main body, except for a level that yielded a Visigothic coin and a 7th century sigillata. While thermoluminescence and carbon dating could incorporate dates from the 7th through the 9th centuries. Melki conforms to a well-known cruciform church of the type pretty well known in the 6th and 7th centuries on the peninsula and in the Mediterranean as well. It uses techniques that ally it with an Iberian and Roman past and decorative forms that find their roots in common Mediterranean late antique lexicon. The alternative suggestion that its masonry, vaulting, and stuccos are the result of the intervention of Syrian masons and artists who arrived with Abd al-Rahman in 755 seems far less likely. The Umayyads employed local labor forces and labor practices in Cordoba as well as in other locations, and used nothing like these techniques in their own patronage. Melki could have been built after 711, since this area was incorporated very late into the Emirate, but as a continuation more of an established pre-conquest tradition. The theory in the interest of which connections to Syria are made, as Juan Carlos Ruiz Sousa and Alexandra Uscatescu have proposed in two encyclopedic rebuttals, tries to connect remote models while ignoring local networks and histories. A second model, San Juan de Baños, the basilica to which I compared San Miguel de Escalada, has a long-standing position as a dated Visigothic basilica located associated with the Visigothic king Recesuinth through an in situ 7th century dedicatory inscription. San Juan was exhaustively surveyed in 1998 by Luis Caballero and Santiago Feijó, who tentatively called the 7th century dating into question on stylistic grounds related, I think, primarily to a fragmented ornamental frieze. However, its nave arcade, for us the signifying aspect of Baños' elevation, is intact, and its beams and clamps are carbon dated to the late Roman period and the 7th century, respectively. So we will work today with these two examples, one a late antique basilica and one a monumental centrally planned building, both employing ashlar masonry and horseshoe arches, traditional hallmarks of late antique architecture of Visigothic rule. Churches like the little San Torquato of Santa Comba de Bande are probably among those restored in the 9th century, although there's disagreement as to how much of it precedes its 9th century restoration. But its reconstruction in any case performs a Visigothic identity, built on the site of one of those abundant ruined monasteries donated by Alfonso III, this time in 872. It was rebuilt, we're told, from the foundations up. It must echo the ruined church on which it was built, a horseshoe arch cruciform plan, reminiscent of Melki, but in miniature, a 9th century construction that reifies the ideology of Visigothic renewal, all the more so because the horseshoe arch had not been a feature in plan or elevation in the architecture of Asturias León before the period of repopulation. So basilicas like Escalada and San Cebrián de Mazote and centrally planned buildings like Santiago Peñalba, all of them 10th century, can be seen as signifiers of a policy of continuity with a lost Visigothic past, promoted by northern monarchies, a platform well documented in the vast literary output of the Leonese court. A much repeated phrase from the Chronicle of Albelda that King Alfonso II established the entire order of the Goths, just as it had been in Toledo, issued from the court of Alfonso III, the very monarch who was constructing this powerful historical metaphor as the ideological framework for his appropriation and resettlement of territories. A remarkable page from the Codex Albaldense illustrates this underlying ideology for the Kingdom of Navarre. King Sancho Garcés, in the center of a grid that shows him as direct heir to Visigothic kings whose law codes are contained in the text, the scribe Vigilius and his disciples below. It is, of course, a visual picture of the transmission of the text, but it's also a political diagram. Sancho Garcés is shown here as the continuation of the legendary Visigothic rulers who appear above him. But how did this policy in León, promoted by a chancery and by northern monastics associated with the crown, interact with Andalusi institutions from the south? They were also partners in this ideological construction, But while Northern bishops and abbots were concerned with the proliferation of typologies, the connection of Andalusi Christians to these models was something more. It was also phenomenological. The models were remembered by them because Andalusi monks had never stopped worshiping in late antique churches of the Visigothic period. Their memory very likely included the somatic experience of the horseshoe arch and of partitioned space. Only one church constructed under Umayyad rule partially survives from this period in Andalusia. At Bobastro, north of Malaga, the remains of a rock-cut basilica at the site of the stronghold of Umar ibn Hafsun, where the rebel leader had established a bishopric and sponsored the construction of churches before his revolt was crushed by Abdulrahman III. In its tripartite east end, horseshoe-shaped apse in plan and horseshoe-arched arcade, exaggerated here by the rock-cut construction, Bobastro's are the partitioned and confined spaces engendered by the Hispanic liturgy, shared by all Iberian Christians. In the capital, in Cordoba, St. Eulogius, the ardent hero of the voluntary martyr movement, we might certainly consider him a hostile witness. So we can believe him when he names 17 functioning churches in Cordoba or its vicinity by name in his writing, lamenting the enforcement of Emir Muhammad I, who, and I quote, ordered churches of a more recent construction to be destroyed and commanded that whatever stood out in the way of new adornments on the old churches, that is anything that had been added to the structure of the old churches at the time of the Arabs, be dismantled, end quote. That's pretty specific. Eulogius thus not only bears witness to the continued construction and repair of churches, but he also shows an acute understanding of their relative antiquity in relationship to the advent of the Umayyads, lamenting the destruction of some church roofs, quote, nearly 300 years after their foundation. He interrupts his scurrilous biography of Muhammad to talk about the construction of churches when the Visigothic king Sisebut, quote, held the royal dignity in Toledo, lauding the wonderful workmanship and high roof of one. His chronicling of such church buildings, quote, erected by the zeal and industry of our fathers, end quote, and of their destruction was in many ways an attempt to cement those buildings into their own material history, a tendency to think about architecture in historical terms that would subsequently meet the politically inspired rebuilding of sites in the north. So it seems likely that the duplication of horseshoe arch basilicas and compact vaulted central plans in the north were triangulated in this visual construction of identity, that it was a language understood for slightly different reasons in both the north and in Al-Andalus. The historicizing consciousness surrounding church building in the south grew from a sensitized notion of the passage of time in a context in which the act of building as a rhetorical expression was constricted. The architectural historicism of the northern Asturian Leonese court grew instead from a more conventional notion of historical renewal and renovation as a tool for political consolidation. The two attitudes came together in a kind of, quote, meeting of matter and imagination, as Michael Ann Holly might have put it, a meeting more compelling to my mind because the interaction between the two groups attempted a reconciliation between a historicized, embodied memory and a strategized, ideological program. Both Northern and Southern Christians were thus poised to perform a sort of material transfiguration of the last Christian hegemony on the peninsula before the advent of Umayyad rule. As Professor Bango showed, churches were reconstructed or constructed ex novo using techniques more or less sophisticated. Buildings of coined or coursed rubble work and others of nicely fitted ashlar are all aligned behind this same vision. This is not about building tradition. There were surely sites whose association with the Visigothic period were misunderstood or invented, because this was on one level a fictive reinvention of the past, but it also seems that there was a clear notion of what represented in the minds of these different patrons a building that could perform an imagined visual memory of a much lamented political and cultural hegemony. And so, although Maius was in all probability a Leonese monk, he participated in a common, historicized, and heightened sense of the capacity of architecture to create and signify specific identities and ideologies. These forms were indexed in a construction of community identities and a return to the promised land, maybe you could consider it, of the Visigothic monarchy, and for Maius also a resistance to a ludic Umayyad architectural identity that threatened to erase their memory of that past. But then, how does the meaning of this movement, militant, politicized, and ingrained in memory, transform when it utilizes forms that are also recognizably Islamicate? Like the apse entrance to the little chapel of San Miguel de Celanova with its compact alfiz, that's the molding that enframes the horseshoe arch, the same as it does at the Great Mosque of Cordoba, or here in the Salon Rico of Medina al-Zahra. Also, and in both of them, both of those extra doses are ballooning kind of grandly. Or consider Santiago de Peñalba, the site of retirement of San Genadio, a great ally of the kings of León who set about rebuilding the sites founded by Visigothic Saint Fructuosus, and in founding institutions that revived his model of Visigothic monasticism. Its plan reflects a cross-plan oratory from the Visigothic period and a late antique double axe type as well. And it was conceived in an ideological context of resistance. The monastery received this jeweled cross from Leonese King Ramiro II in honor of his victory against Abdalrahman at Simancas in 939, cementing the monastery's relationship with the monarchy and its triumphal goals. And yet, for all its historicism and militant ardor, both the apse entrance and the principal doorways are embraced by an alfiz, as in the 9th century door of the Great Mosque of Cordoba, and the enclosed horseshoe arches of more recent Cordoban structures, their springers ending in sharp, elegant points. Maria de los Angeles Utrero has called this transcultural, and I believe she's correct, but I do not see these changes in style happening only because of the possible intervention of Andalusi craftsmen or Muslim slaves, as has recently been suggested. These forms significantly impact the identity of the building, and they appear in multiple different workshop traditions. In the context of the heightened consciousness of style that was 10th century León, it's difficult to imagine that the design and appearance of the apse would be passively abdicated by such engaged patrons as the monks of Santiago, intent on reviving Visigothic monasticism. They were chosen in a way that might instead seem to us ideologically contrary. Indeed, when I first wrote about these churches, I could not imagine these two ideas coexisting temporally. On one side, the retentive conservative political narrative of Visigothic renewal at Escalada with its erasure of post-conquest history, and the other, which I saw as a more ambivalent cultural and ideological identity. And this apparent contradiction was one reason that John Williams and Patrick Henriet both doubted the ideological freight of the Morgan Beatus page. We all had had difficulty reconciling the implicit ideological inconsistency of the architecture and the manuscript. In the face of this perceived contradiction, I sought to explain that those works of the 10th century corpus that showed a clear connection with Andalusi architecture could be grouped in a later period in which ideology of resistance had waned. But then there's a problem. Santiago de Peñalba dates only 3 years before the assumed date of Maius' feast in a manuscript that would soon be found at the monastery of San Miguel de Escalada, where a porch completed in a later campaign than the nave is conventionally dated to the same years as the manuscript's execution. And that's kind of interesting that they might order the manuscript and make a new porch at the same time. The little window with a doubled horseshoe arch can be traced to Roman and Visigothic models, but the sharp radical profile of the horseshoe arches of the porch and the alfys, they're something else altogether. Honoring the past, yes, and yet not resisting the present. Among the canonical churches privileged by Gómez Moreno, the Basilica of San Cebrián de Mazote, which cannot be securely dated, is also a consummately late antique building, a horseshoe-arched wooden-roof basilica like San Juan de Baños, Hispanic in its liturgical expression, almost Ottonian in its monumentality. But at Mazote, there are also arches painted with alternating voussoirs and a ballooning extrabados, small vestiges of a grand lost painting scheme which apparently covered much of the church. And this same polychromy is found at Santiago de Peñalba, an admiration of Andalusi forms. The banded arches at Mazote and Peñalba cannot be budged to converge semiotically within the arch that harbors Balthazar's feast. And yet the monks at Peñalba and Escalada would certainly heartily agree with Maius's point that this architectural form marked the impious regime that must fall. But while the alternating voussoirs took on a cosmic meaning as part of the connecting tissue of scripture and present in Maius's Beatus commentary, the ideological consistency generated in this scriptorium's hermetic space was not possible in architectural expression. Contrary to our general assumptions, it is in this case, I think, in the scriptorium that the ideological point would be made in an unsullied way. And yet, both of these discourses, resistant and transcultural, existed simultaneously in the same times and in the same places among the same patrons. I didn't mean to do that. Reconciliation might well have come from Christians from the South, but not only from the texts of the voluntary martyrs. Dominique Lavoie proposed in a brilliant article, I think, that those Andalusi Christians who brought the term Mustarab North might have adopted the term both in pride at their assumption of Arab culture, a measure of prestige in Al-Andalus, and as they came north, also as a way of identifying with the earliest legendary Arab Christians who fought with the Byzantines in their first efforts against the expansion of Islam. They found a way, Lavoie asserted, to mold their Arab cultural identity into something like mythic Christian freedom fighters against Islam, as they offered themselves to the Leonese kings of the north. As some Christians proposed an identity resistant to Islamic culture, others, proud of their Andalusi culture, proposed the creation of a militant Christian Andalusi identity. And there might be something to this theory, as it gave the northern kingdoms a structure for separating culture from confession. As Andalusi Christians were appointed to episcopates, as contemporary church councils began to crowd with Arabic names, and since, for instance, as D. Fairchild's Ruggles reminded us in an essay on the variety of sources of transculturation, Ramiro II's mother-in-law, the great Queen Toda of Navarre, was a great aunt of the Caliph Abdulrahman III, a product of the strategic reproductive practices of the Umayyads. Toda, by the way, brilliantly exploited those family connections, as Glare Anderson has shown. Profound interaction, diplomatic envoys, tribute and truces, kaleidoscopic alliances, intermarriages, trade, as Rose Walker's recent survey amply points out, were occurring among secular rulers, church officials, aristocrats, and their families in the north, at the same time that all of their chanceries were protesting fierce resistance to a reductive Muslim foe and claiming uninterrupted continuity with Visigothic renewal. And then, what was I thinking? For while I was trying to shoehorn resistant or transcultural architectural styles into separate chronological boxes, I was ignoring this, in the same Beatus manuscript by Maius, as the Feast of Balthazar and as that ominous page of Babylon. Another image of Babylon is a glorious celebration of an Arab city, bristling with color, texture, and interest, and opulent objects, a miniature probably also inspired by a portal of the court of a mosque. You have to look at this jubilant urban portrait for a long time before you see the city is in flames, flames so delicate and evanescent that they almost disappear. It is, in fact, Babylon in the throes of its own apocalyptic demise. The image on one hand equates Babylon with Cordoba, predicts the wicked city's destruction within the context of cosmic history, and yet there's slippage even for Maius, because on another level, it luxuriates in this animate, florid, urban fabric. Like the churches, it is strident in its politics, and yet it also so glories in a visual identity shared beyond confession that its attempt to subvert this Babylon as an evil and doomed metropolis without dragons is really rather ineffectual. The simple religious metaphor was subsumed by a far more complex cultural identity. Just such a tangled cultural identity can be read most poignantly in the words of the martyr Saint Eulogius himself in his Memoriale Sanctorum. In the middle of an invective against the oppression of the voluntary martyrs by Umayyad rulers, Eulogius wrote what might be a caption for this very image. "One unspeakably cruel martyrdom took place," he said, in, quote, "an era in which Abdulrahman II had submitted almost the entire Iberian Peninsula to his hard rule. But it was also the time in which he'd elevated the city of Cordoba to its summit, covered it with honor, strewn it with glory and accumulated riches, with an amplitude surpassing the imagination, of a kind that crushes in its radiance all his royal predecessors in all that touches secular display. While on the other hand, the Orthodox Church trembled beneath his yoke." There were multiple simultaneous discourses in the north, a polarized discourse about confessional identity and political resistance, and also numerous dynamic discourses about Protean cultural identities. Their varied languages were born of the fluidity of peoples and polities, epistemological doors forced open by abrupt shifts in political and territorial ground, and the resulting connections with ideas from both north and south of an expansive, increasingly permeable frontier. Decorations such as the paintings of Mazote or Peñalba reflect the conscious celebration of a cosmopolitanism dislodged from the idea of confession, one that apparently sat comfortably with the Leonese ideology of a Visigothic renewal, both as it was felt by monastic and secular patrons. Clearly, those monks of Escalada and Mazote who came from the south and their heirs did not believe they were bringing Muslim culture north. They were bringing the culture of their patria, both its late antique typologies and its elegant new cosmopolitan styles. Their patria, as the dedication of San Miguel de Escalada declared. Frontiers were, in fact, far more permeable, more mercurial than they appear in our historical imagination. And finally, there's this. If San Cebrián de Mazote and San Santiago de Peñalba were entirely painted throughout their interiors, on what basis can I continue to insist on the pristine interior of San Miguel de Escalada, so many times restored, as a monument of austere resistance to Islamicate culture? Was Escalada's interior originally also a riot of alternating voussoirs? Heavens, I hope so. Thank you.